Welcome to The Sound of Economics, the podcast series by Bruegel, the Brussels-based economics think tank. I'm Jeremy Zettelmeyer, the director of Bruegel, and today we're going to speak about the EU gas market outlook for this year, for 2023. And with me are Simone Tagliapietra, who is senior fellow at Bruegel, working mainly on energy policy and climate issues, and Ben McWilliams, energy and climate consultant, also at Bruegel. So the backdrop to our podcast is, of course, the energy crisis that we maybe still have, but we certainly had it last year. So we were in crisis mode most of the year, even before the invasion of Ukraine. Prices were very high. Then they went to unimaginable heights in August and September. There was a lot of pain. There were huge fiscal packages. There was a lot of worry that essentially the electricity market would fall apart in the EU, that countries would do their own thing, and that we would have a significant recession this year. And, you know, with hindsight, it wasn't as bad. Of course, it was partly less bad than we might have imagined because, you know, consumers, industry, and policymakers to a large extent did the right thing. But now we have to look forward to this year and particularly to the next winter. And not all the factors that brought us through this winter to this past one might apply for the next one. Now, for this purpose, we published a policy brief a few weeks ago entitled Preparing for the Next Winter, Europe's Gas Outlook for 2023, which was written by Ben McWilliams, who's here with us, Simone Tagliapietra, Georg Zachmann, and Thierry Descoitener. And starting from this paper, I would now ask the two of you, Simone and Ben, to discuss what we need to do this year to prevent the energy crisis from happening. So maybe let's start by looking backward a little bit. Simone, Europe looks in a better position today than we had anticipated, as I just said, and so why was this? And to the extent that we did the right thing or to the extent that there were factors that prevented the worst from happening, can we take it for granted that they will continue? Are we out of the woods or not?
Thank you, Jeremy. And indeed, I think we can now certainly look back at last year as one of the most dramatic years when it comes to the energy situation, the energy market in Europe, and more largely, I would say, at the global level. It was a dramatic year because Europe went through a perfect storm that was mainly related, of course, to Russia invasion of Ukraine and the related weaponization of energy by Russia, but also by a series of coincidences that happened all of a sudden time. One of them being a major disruption in the nuclear reactors in France, half of the fleet offline due to the need of extraordinary maintenance. At the same time, Europe experienced the worst drought in the summer of the last 500 years, which significantly impacted the hydropower output. So the situation was really under unprecedented stress. And notwithstanding this perfect storm, Europe managed to go through this unprecedented time, I think, in a pretty good manner, because in a matter of a few months, Europe was ultimately able to shift away from Russian gas. Russian gas used to represent 40% of the European imports of gas, and now they represent less than 10%. The markets and institutions were able to face this situation. The markets delivered in the sense that Europe was able to replace the Russian molecules with alternative molecules, and the price signal were sufficient and strong enough, of course, to push demand reduction in both households and firms. All in all, we went through the storm, and after the peak of the volatility we have seen in August, energy prices have started to decline. Now, if there are two pillars of the European energy security, I think the first certainly is LNG, and the other certainly is demand reduction. Now, LNG has represented the main channel for Europe to replace Russian gas. LNG used to make up 20% of the European import requirements of gas. Now it represents 40%. Europe was able to attract in 2022 additional 50 billion cubic meters of LNG, which, just to provide an order of magnitude, is four times the LNG demand shock that we had at the global level after the Fukushima incident in Japan. Of course, Europe was able to secure these additional volumes also because of the zero COVID policy in China, which pushed downward the demand for LNG in the country significantly by the order of 20 billion cubic meters. So that was a lucky coincidence, let's say, for the European market, and is one of the major elements of uncertainty looking forward, because certainly the demand for LNG in China might recover in the coming months. The second element, demand reduction. Demand reduction was agreed to be achieved in the order of 15% during the winter, and this target set at the European level is certainly being met. So countries are delivering, and again, the price signal certainly played the key role. But apart from that, I think we also had a bit of luck after a very, very difficult year, because the temperatures in the fall have been particularly warm. The winter has also been warmer than usual, and this has certainly helped to reduce the demand for gas in the household sector. So all in all, we currently are in a safer situation that many of us could have even hoped, I would say, until a few months ago. Currently, we are heading toward the end of the winter with the storages still more than 60% full. This is a major element of security for Europe. And I would say the less we will utilize these storages moving forward in the coming weeks, the easier it will be to get prepared for the next winter. So as you said at the beginning, it is important to appreciate that European energy security for this year and the next starts now. We need to continue to put in place the right measures to keep the demand reduced as we move forward. And of course, all the possible actions to diversify and keep the LNG coming into Europe. It is also very important that countries continue to roll out the floating storage regasification units as they are. We need to deliver this infrastructure on schedule, because that is very important to ensure the capacity to attract and dispatch the LNG in an efficient manner around the European countries. And of course, I think we need to keep increasing the cooperation at the European level. Leaving the markets open has been one of the most important achievements last year, and I think that has really proven to be one of the key to face this unprecedented moment of stress. And I think this European solidarity and cooperation needs to continue and get stronger as we move forward.
Mm-hmm. Maybe before I ask Ben to explain a bit where demand reduction needs to continue or come from, let me just maybe push you on one point a little bit. We wrote a series of papers, you wrote a series of papers last year, basically arguing that unless there was a grand bargain, as we called it, on energy, involving basically a lot of policy coordination, a lot of extra effort, both on the demand and the supply side from several European countries, we might face a disaster. Now, did we avoid the disaster because policymakers listened to us and there was a great bargain, or did we avoid a disaster in spite of the fact that there really wasn't such a great bargain, just out of a combination of markets operating, good luck, China not using so much LNG, and a warm winter?
I would say it's a mix. No, the most important element is that at the end of the day, ultimately, countries have avoided the temptation of closing the border of their energy markets.
Right.
So even during the peak of the crisis and the worst days of the crisis, where we really had the fear of scarcity of molecules, countries kept sharing the scarce energy resources, gas right. and electricity. That was something that honestly was not to be taken for granted. Mm-hmm. And I think it really allowed Europe to basically go through the worst of the situation without physical disruptions. Again, right. we never had 1 hour of physical disruption. I think that is something we need to really flag.
So was it mostly about bad stuff not happening? So there was no attempt to
Absolutely,
do yes. economic nationalism on energy, like we have seen, for example, on finance in the global financial crisis. This did not happen.
Yeah.
And there was, in the end, in spite of very large energy subsidies, there was not a subsidy race in the sense of trying to grab demand from each other, right? So the subsidies, for the most part, were reasonably designed to with a savings objective. So in that sense, policymakers can take some credit for demand reduction, at least in some countries, and maybe also a little bit for supply expansion. So, for example, did new LNG terminals already play a role last winter? And what about, you know, German nuclear and that sort of thing?
So there, I think you really need to look at the European map and appreciate the fact that countries sitting in the south
yes.
already had access to alternative energy gas right. sources, right? So, right. for example, what Italy did with Algeria, trying to ramp up the supply of gas from Algeria, it was very important, and the other deals with African countries, because that is something you can tap into immediately. If you look at Germany, of course, doesn't have that possibility, geographically speaking. What Germany could do and did is to build up in an extremely prompt manner the floating storage and regasification units that the country needs in order to import directly LNG without the congestion that we have seen in the grid last
year. Did one of these units already come on stream in last winter?
No.
No.
So the floating storage and regasification units are now starting
okay.
to come online, and then they will be key for the security of the coming winter.
Mm-hmm. Got it.
And just to make clear also to all the one listening, I think it's important to appreciate that with these floating storage and regasification units, we are not going to necessarily import more LNG than last year, but we are going to be able to dispatch this LNG directly into Germany by avoiding the transit that we have seen in the last months that created a congestion in the grid around Germany, because the system was not designed to deliver LNG into Germany at that scale. And that also was one of the elements underpinning the volatility of the TTF, the
right.
famous
right.
gas benchmark.
Ben, let's talk a little more about the demand side. So basically in the paper you argue, if I remember correctly, that in your baseline, that is depending on baseline expectations on supply and on temperature. So, you know, there are various drivers that could make a difference. So the LNG terminal expansion, temperature, China coming back and using a lot of the free gas in the world market. But sort of focusing on the baseline, we need about the same level of demand reduction of savings this year, 2023, that we actually had last year, right? Something in the order of 15%. Now, it sounds really easy, right? I mean, we already reduced demand by 15%. All we need to do is kind of stay at that level. Is that the right way of reading it? And, you know, if so, does it actually require extra effort? I mean, to what extent were the factors that allowed us to reduce demand last year structural, in the sense that, you know, once we have done that, it just, we can continue at that lower level? Or to what extent was this an extraordinary effort that, unless we do something very drastic, is just going to be reversed?
Indeed. So also in the grand bargain, this was one of the pillars where I think we can agree that Europe has delivered so far. And I mean, in January, for example, we continue to see about a 25% reduction in demand compared to the previous 3-year average, which goes against a 15% demand reduction target that's currently agreed at the European Union level, against a slightly different baseline. But these numbers are still very, very positive. And as you hint at, the big question is how we go about achieving these demand reductions, how we have done for the past months, and how we will continue. I think a nice way to decompose it is by to begin by sectors. So there are three large consuming areas in Europe's gas system, all roughly consuming about a third, and a third. It changes by country. These are the power sector, the industrial sector, and the household sector. Power, of course, for the generation of electricity. Industry is your big chemical plants, your big steel plants, where they consume gas directly in a furnace or directly to produce ammonia, not via electricity. And finally, households who want to heat our homes. So far, what we've seen is, as also Simona has hinted at, the power sector didn't help us at all, which was very unfortunate. In the power sector, there are normally big flexibilities, particularly between gas and coal in the short run, where you have coal units and gas units, which you can ramp up and ramp down depending on prices. So normally the ETS, the carbon price in the power sector, this has a complex interaction with gas and coal prices. And you'll see, if you look at the data, you'll see these changing over time. And if you were just suddenly thrown into the EU and you knew there was a shortage of gas, probably your first answer would have been, okay, let's temporarily boost coal and lower gas. The challenge was, last year, the power system was also very strained by very weak output, both from French nuclear plants, but also from hydro plants, largely in South Europe, Spain and Italy, which was a result of droughts during the summer. And what this meant was there was very little spare capacity in the power sector. And actually, as a result, we saved almost no gas in the power sector. Looking forward, the French nuclear plants are coming back online, and it's possible again we will have a drought, but it was a 1 in a 500-year event. Maybe with climate change, you might say it's becoming more likely. But I mean, the status quo is that we will have a more relaxed power sector going forward, and that will definitely help being able to save more gas in the power sector. So how we achieved it so far was industry and households. That's where all of the reductions came. And this was largely driven by prices. There were some government announcements and efforts and asking people to save gas, but I think largely at the end of the day, what drove this were prices, both at the household level, where consumers turned down their thermostats, put on a jumper, and were forced to lower consumption over the winter months to save on bills, and at the industry level, where there is a significant flexibility, I think that many were surprised by, for switching away from gas. Now, in industry, this can happen in a few different manners. And one of the pieces of good news that we've seen over this winter is that a lot of it was by substitution. So not necessarily curtailment, which is the fear that for every unit of gas you reduce a unit of output by one. And this would lead to very bad economic consequences for Europe, deindustrialization, et cetera. What we actually saw was that industry was quite resilient and able to switch in largely in two ways. One, fuel switching. So partly going to oil is typically the fuel they would have been able to switch to. And secondly, import substitution, where you import some stages of the value chain, so it's kind of the gas-intensive stages of the value chain. You directly import them, potentially from America, and you could keep further stages of the value chain domestically, potentially with labor there, which in a sense was a way of circumventing import capacity of gas into Europe by importing basically gas, but in a different form, say ammonia. Looking forward, I think you've asked it in your question, and it's the difficult one is how much of this was structural and how much of this was transitory, where everything that's transitory, as prices lower, you would expect to bounce back in demand, and everything that's structural, I think, is positive, both for relaxing Europe's gas balances over the coming months and also for Europe's energy transition. So some of the structural elements were the heat pump deployment, where we are seeing, I think at Bruegel, hopefully soon, we will also have some data on this. But the data coming out at national levels are showing really unprecedented records being broken in almost every single European country for the heat pump deployment. So this is at the household level, and it's typically shifting away from a gas boiler to a heat pump, where, you know, so households are taking the message that, okay, in the short run, they lowered consumption, but at the same time, gas was shown to be a very, very expensive fuel, and people wanted to make a decision who has the capital available to invest in alternatives. Renewables, one big positive for me has been an agreement that maybe largely went unnoticed outside of energy circles on what's called permitting reform. So one of the big bottlenecks for renewables has been that they've been for a while now cost competitive for producing electricity. Solar and wind are extremely competitive. The challenge has been finding the land where you want to build it and getting the approval to go ahead. Sometimes NIMBYism is an acronym people use, not in my backyard, which I think in Germany has been a big big issue. And there's been an agreement at the European level and a push that this permitting reform will get moving. What it's basically saying is now it's time to get your hands dirty and really start building renewables, which is, again, a big positive. So both on heat pumps, renewables, and an industry, that there are also structural elements. And the big message is that for Europe, gas prices are still two or three times higher than they were pre-invasion or pre-COVID. So it's unlikely that gas demand would structurally return back to where it used to be. Many investments have been made that are irreversible. And secondly, prices are still higher. So looking forward, I would expect that we are able to achieve this demand reduction in the coming months. But it still requires a focus on it. And just to close, one element is that there is a European Union agreement until the end of March to aim for a 15% demand reduction, if you want to call this a grand bargain. That expires in March. And one of the recommendations we made in the report is that this should be extended to October until we get the storages full again.
Right. Simone, apart from extending the demand target, what should EU governments do to make sure that we get through the next winter?
Well, related to demand reduction, I think we need to appreciate what really also Ben said, that in the last months for Europe, it was not only possible to achieve the gas demand reduction target, but also go beyond that, because we had an extremely strong pricing. I mean, faced with extremely high energy bills, families and firms tried to, you know, find all the possible solutions to reduce their demand. The problem now for Europe is that we need to continue to have these demand reduction moving forward, as Ben said, until at least October this year, even in a situation where the prices are actually declining. So at that point, since the price signal might not be sufficient anymore to push the demand reduction we actually need, because we still are sit on a very tight gas market, governments need to ramp up policies to incentivize this demand reduction. And I think that on this element, we need to do more, because while at the beginning of the crisis, we started to see policies to, you know, going in this direction, I think the price effect was much quicker.
That's
and
right.
Somehow took over the governmental intervention and did the job.
But haven't some of these policies been designed in a way that maintains higher prices while avoiding peaks, like, you know, the famous or infamous, I don't know, German gas price break? Did it not? So to what extent were the energy subsidies that we have put in place smart, in the sense that they maintain sort of the longer term price signal while avoiding the peak? Is it, this is not a general phenomenon? It's sort of basically country specific.
You know, that really depends on the country you're looking at, right? Because in certain countries, you had these regulated prices at the retail level, for, you know, most of them, or the 80% of the consumption of an household, so to incentivize the demand reduction, as in the case of Germany. But in other countries, you have seen more temporary measures. So overall, I think all governments need to think twice about demand reduction, how to keep incentivizing that. And utilities as well have a role to play here. So also utilities can come up with solutions to incentivize demand reduction in their customers. So this is something that is of paramount importance, because as we have discussed since the beginning, demand reduction will have to remain a key feature of the European gas security of supply in general for at least the next year or so, until we have an overall rebalancing in the global energy market, more supply comes online, and therefore we go beyond the current tight market market condition.
So basically your fear is that in some sense these subsidies or price controls that exist in the market operate in an asymmetric fashion, so they took away the worst peaks, but they did allow some pass through of high market prices while market prices were very high. But if market prices fall, they would actually allow a pass through of the much lower prices, which would then possibly lead to a reversal, right? So we are not there, like Ben said, market prices are still much higher, but there is a scenario out there where this could happen, right? Yeah.
So, and we have seen that, of course, rolling back certain measures can be politically difficult.
Of course.
So we know also the politics of that.
Right.
So this is one element.
Yes.
The other element, if we look at the, you know, we are on a tight market. Our problem is this imbalance in the demand supply. So we need to also look at what to do on the supply side. And there, I think there are two things that European governments should be focusing on. On the one hand, ensure, as we discussed, the rollout of the infrastructure. Mm-hmm. We need to attract more alternative LNG, and the floating storage and regasification units are the most important elements in there. But then there is the whole issue about getting the LNG supplies themselves.
Mm-hmm.
And the point there is to what extent Europe should go for long-term contracts. That has been a bit of a dilemma, no? In the last years, should we sign up to these 20 years long-term contracts with LNG suppliers or not? Because we still, you know, not only need to decarbonize, but out of this crisis, possibly the trajectory for gas demand in Europe will be different. We will consume less gas moving forward because of all the substitution that is happening and is in part structural. Of course, what is the problem? The problem is that while we are predominantly on the spot market when it comes to LNG, Asian economies, namely China, have been signing up a lot of long-term contracts on LNG. So that has somehow shielded them by the volatility last year, because some of these contracts are all indexed, other are indexed to the Henry Hub and so on. So the question is, can Europe remain predominantly on the spot market for 40% of its import requirements of LNG, while other Asian countries, for example, are more secure because they are signing up to these long-term contracts? I think we need to find a middle ground there and probably accept the fact that at least to a certain extent, a certain level of long-term contracts is needed.
Right.
Because it's a matter of guaranteeing a certain stability in the coming years, because gas will still be around in Europe for at least the next 10, 15 years. So this is for gas. But then, as Ben said, we need to get possibly even more serious about the green solutions and the green rollout.
Mm-hmm.
I think we have started to go in the right direction, and the permitting reform that Ben mentioned is important, was finalized in December at the EU level, but now it needs to be implemented at the national level, and let's see whether this will actually get done. I think it's extremely relevant for wind, because while last year, for example, we have seen an impressive acceleration in the imports, and we are tracking that at Bruegel in our dataset, in the imports of solar panels into the EU, and we know that we import, namely from China, 90% of the solar panels we deploy, so that's a good proxy to understand what's going on in the market.
Mm-hmm.
We have not been so successful in the rollout of wind energy, because of this permitting issue, namely. So we do have bottlenecks there. So I think facing these specific bottleneck is of paramount importance, and we still have a lot of work to do in order to make this real. And then, of course, we also need to tackle the issue of the energy subsidies that you mentioned. We have been tracking those at Bruegel since September 2021.
This is fossil energy.
This is mainly subsidies, of course, to fossil, to fossil energy. Mm-hmm. We have so far, since September 21, allocated, not necessarily spent, allocated or earmarked 657 billion euros for these measures, so-called to shield consumers from high energy prices. We know that most of these measures have been untargeted, have been general, and there is now a high pressure by the ECB, by many, on governments to say, okay, now that prices are going down, try to get, you know, targeted, tailored, and I would say transition proof. I think there is now a case to start moving the subsidies also to the green solution that will allow families and businesses to structurally decouple from fossil fuels that are going to be volatile in the coming years. Mm-hmm. And one example here can be, for just to name one specific example, the opportunity of subsidizing the adoption of a heat pump in low-income households. Heat pumps have these problems, of course, of the high upfront cost, and a governmental intervention to lower these upfront costs can be extremely important to structurally get rid of the problem in the most vulnerable. So we have an opportunity now to get out of the emergency measures, focus now on the structural measures that can not only green our economy and accelerate our green transition, but possibly also do something about inequality.
Right. So this is back to the theme of subsidizing energy savings in a durable sense rather than energy consumption. Ben, maybe a final question for you. What if Russia decides to resume gas sales to Europe? I mean, first of all, how likely is that? And if they did, how would we react? How should we react? As far as I know, there are no sanctions and on gas in the sense that there's no boycott of gas. But you know, maybe there should be. I mean, can you imagine a situation where they turn up the tap again, and then we're sort of back to consuming large amounts of gas? I know structurally there are targets to get out of it, but how would this actually all work?
As you say, there's no EU-level sanctions on natural gas, which people often forget. Often it has been a successful transition away from Russian gas, but it's been one which was forced by Russia, which is different to oil, crude oil and refined products, where the EU has come forward with embargoes and own sanctions. So for gas, no sanctions. What happened is Russia and Putin tried to weaponize gas exports. And the way they did this was by lowering them to Europe with lots of narrative going along with this. And from week to week, there was new press releases, new announcements that there was a new problem with one turbine, a new problem with another route. And this was always designed to manipulate European markets, pushing up prices and causing panic in European gas markets, which making it so necessary last year for Europe to fill up storages with these huge government subsidies and pushing prices up in August to record highs. Now, there's four routes through which Russia exports gas to Europe. One, Nord Stream 1 to Germany, as people by now know, has been blown up. Somebody has blown this one up. So this one, in the short term, there's no possibility for Russia to increase gas exports. A second route is via Poland through what's called the Yamal pipeline. There are sanctions on using this pipeline from the European side, and this would be very unlikely for flows to continue here. They're also at zero. That leaves us with the two remaining routes. The first is
So there's a sanction specifically on that pipeline?
On the use of that pipeline, yes.
And that has something to do with forcing the Russians to route gas through Ukraine, or what is the background?
As far as I recall, it came in fact, even after the flows had dropped to zero. So it was more a counter sanction on not using this pipeline anymore. It flows through Poland. Yeah. And Ukraine and what's called Turk Stream, that flows through Turkey up to Hungary and Serbia. Turk Stream to Hungary and Serbia is flowing still at very high levels. And this is largely to do with political closeness between these countries and Russia. And these flows we would expect to continue. Then you have the Ukraine transit, where flows are still quite volatile. And the reason for this is that Russia still sits on a large share of unfulfilled contracts with European companies, which theoretically from week to week, European companies can nominate higher volumes, could nominate higher volumes, and these should flow through the pipeline. And there's no obvious reason why this could not happen legally, physically, infrastructurally. So that's a risk in the short run that Russia might pivot from the strategy of weaponizing flows by cutting them to zero to selectively increasing flows to certain companies, certain countries, who in return might provide some political favors. And in the short run, I think that some European level agreements on limiting flows, on potentially some of the contracts being void, but I'm preventing this possibility and this temptation, taking the temptation away from companies or countries to engage in this kind of behavior is what's needed in the short run. In the longer run, if we look over the next 3, 4, 5 years, one of the big problems with signing new long-term contracts and thinking about the gas system of the future is Russian gas will still be there. It can't go anywhere else. It's not connected to any other export routes. And the pipelines will still be there, the ones that aren't blown up. And what that means is that if you want to make a plan for signing a 15 or 20-year contract with an American LNG supplier, you have considerable uncertainty over whether through regime change, through peace in Ukraine, I mean, who knows how the world looks in 5 years' time, all of a sudden the infrastructure would be there for this gas to again flow to Europe, and it would be considerably cheaper than LNG imports. So this is something else which potentially needs to be addressed for the future, where the EU is now setting up a platform for the purchase of LNG on international markets, and some consideration might be given to the idea of setting a fixed volume, a maximum volume of Russian gas that could be imported, let's say 10%, which compares to 40% before, because clearly we never want the situation again of overwhelming market power, potentially a fixed price negotiated at the European Union level to kind of, in a sense, depoliticize the whole trade, but respect and if we are interested in the future in importing again. So I think there's two different solutions, one in the short term, in the immediate term, and one looking forward, kind of in a peacetime scenario, what might happen.
Excellent. Okay, something else to think about. Well, thank you so much. I think that's all for this episode. Again, you can find the paper on which the podcast is based. It's called Preparing for the Next Winter, Europe's Gas Outlook for 2023, on our website, www.google.org. That's all from The Sound of Economics. Thank you very much for listening in. Bye.